Nej. All right, hello everybody. Welcome to Friday, 5 p.m. in the Friday edition of American Hit Radio, or How Music Changed. I'm your host, Tom Ryan. I'm here with Heidi Morales Ryan.
I'm back again.
Got our engineer Earl Holder helping us out here, which is a real good thing, making sure that I stay on track as much as possible. If you've been listening on Fridays, you know that we've been covering a lot of historical shows, things about basically discussing how music changed, how we got to where we are today. We've been going back way back in time for some shows and doing a few other shows where we come a little bit closer to the contemporary nature of things. Right now, we're back at the beginning. I don't know if you've heard our other shows that were on early topics, but we've discussed everything from literally from like the original American Indian music, as it was called, or Native American music, to what happened since there was the landing at the Mayflower and the development of music since then. We've discussed a number of topics, including how European music eventually came to America and made itself felt here and eventually transposed itself into something that resembled American style. And today, we're going to try to bring all of those things that we've discussed of our previous early shows, all of them, to see if we can pull them all together in one show, which is going to be essentially on the birth of jazz. You could also call this jazz or the eventual acceptance of African-American musical influence on popular music. Now, it's going to be a while to get there. What we are hearing in the background right now as I'm speaking is a track from Ken Burns' Civil War series that he had done, which is actually an authentic piece from a band that was recorded during the Civil War. That is pretty much where we need to start, because that is the type of music that started the eventual fervor for band music. Now, ultimately, we got to end up in New Orleans as the birthplace of jazz. Now, the first question is how and why? Well, New Orleans was, and in many ways still is, the most culturally diverse city in the United States, circa 1900, probably in the world. For a great portion of the city's history, black, white, and every imaginable shade in between lived together. There was a slave trade around the time of the Civil War in New Orleans, a very active one, in fact, but there were free blacks as well. Mixing with the free blacks and the slaves, there were Spanish, French, Caribbean mixes, Irish, German, Italian, a real genuine potpourri of humandom was living in New Orleans, quite the group. The blacks blended with everybody just as much as you could say that the French blended with the Spanish. It was just the way that the city functioned. There was also a lot of interracial marriage going on. It was a place where this mix, just by virtue of the fact that they lived in such close quarters, they accepted one another. You could have even had a situation where in the exact same room, they could have had taken a hotel ballroom where they were going to be auctioning off slaves, and in the corner of the ballroom, there could have been a Creole band made up of black musicians who were free, providing entertainment while they were selling the black slaves, all in the same room in New Orleans.
It's bizarre to think about.
If you could imagine that. But this was where the culture was at about that time, during the Civil War. The blends of the races that eventually resulted from blacks intermingling were called Creoles. And just like the various shades of their skin, they also exhibited various degrees of musical influence from their mixed cultures. They even had names. I mean, part of like the racism that was going on is you judge somebody by the level of black blood that they actually had in them. In New Orleans, you could actually be known as a quadroon or an octoroon, being one quarter black or one eighth black. It didn't really mean so much in terms of where you might have fit in society, though, because the Creoles had their own culture that was very proud and very strong, and they considered themselves to be very appropriate. In some ways, they were very strictly tied to the European styles of music. Another thing that made New Orleans incredibly exceptional, and another reason why New Orleans was the right place at the right time for jazz to happen there, is that it was mostly a Catholic city. You need to consider that. I mean that in both senses of the word, the capital C sense and the small C sense. I know it's literally the city, in terms of its religion, was mostly Catholic. And figuratively, in terms of tastes and culture, the city was the same way. I don't know, the small C definition of the word Catholic, if you look it up in the dictionary, means liberal.
Which is hard to believe.
Very strange and hard to believe. But if you compare, say...
Because you hardly think of Catholics as being liberal.
Particularly liberal.
But I guess for the time.
But if you think about Catholic culture, particularly in New Orleans, and compare that to the Protestant cultures that we had discussed in our earlier shows,
right,
with what was happening, say, in Massachusetts with witch hunts and no dancing allowed and no singing allowed, Catholics were liberal. So that could very well be the definition of where that word came from, and that probably is the derivation of the word. Anyway, in New Orleans, dancing was not sinful. Playing music was considered to be a welcome diversion. The Civil War, much like that track that we had just heard, started the spread of band music throughout the country, and naturally, New Orleans took to it with a fervor. Now, again, why? Well, because there was no Protestant resistance to it like there was in other places. So in the wake of the war, as it ended, and slavery ended in its wake, there was a near mania for brass instruments that developed within the city. Everybody was learning to play brass instruments. It's a tradition that to this day still exists very strongly, yeah, in the city. The blacks who were slaves are now free, although not necessarily on equal footing. They start to join into this whole big mess of what's happening in New Orleans. The musicians start to mix, as well as the different races. You have dance bands, marching bands, church music, blues, and even, of course, ragtime, which was just beginning to develop. All of this stuff is now being played all over the city. One style is affecting another. They're all beginning to meld together. These different bands also often shared personnel, almost like today as well in New Orleans. You could be playing in a blues group somewhere in one club one day, and then Sunday you'd be playing in church, and then you'd have a dance gig where you'd have to go up to play in the park by the lake. And then you'd maybe even have some opera shows were taking place at that time. Even minstrel music got a unique spin in New Orleans around this time. If you remember, we discussed about the blackface artists that were coming about and coming and going and were developing, right, the minstrel sound. Well, in New Orleans, it took an interesting spin because in New Orleans, the black-faced whites would show up to play and do their minstrel stuff and sing their quote-unquote coon songs. But in New Orleans, they would have to share the stage with genuine black performers because they were considered legitimate New Orleans. Very strange type of a scenario. So you see, in so many ways, New Orleans was absolutely unique for the United States of America. Even before the Civil War, the slaves blended in. They had to in order to survive. They mixed their religions with, like, the original voodoo religions that they had from the native cultures were blended with Catholicism, and they ended up, to this day, those blends still exist. Again, I mean, all this stuff remains contemporary. They mixed their music, African influences, Afro-Caribbean music,
Native American music.
Native American music, of course, right. They brought music that they took from the Indians, hymns from Europe, and of course, I said ragtime. On Sundays, you could hear all of this at a place called Congo Square in New Orleans.
That's right.
Or you could go up to the park and you'd hear brass bands playing in the park. Or you could hear opera in any one of as many as five different opera houses, depending on how formally you counted the opera houses. And of course, there were the minstrel show bands, which were travelers. They would come in and out of the city constantly, and they would pick up everything and bring all this stuff into New Orleans. A phrase that began to develop around this time was ragging, which is you'd be playing a popular song, but in New Orleans, because these guys were actually beginning to, like, do their own original unique take on these popular songs, mm-hmm, the phrase was called ragging on the tune. Like, you take it and you do it in your own style. You were ragging. Eventually, of course, this was formalized as ragtime, mm-hmm, elsewhere outside of New Orleans, but New Orleans knew all about what rag really was. Now, okay, that's setting up our story for New Orleans, but to tell the full story, I've got to take a little bit of a sidestep right now. We've got to step out of New Orleans a little bit because there's a New York corollary to this story that also needs to be explained. New York, actually, is where the minstrel blends that we were talking about began to take place, began to mix with serious composition. For example, I'll tell you what. Let's take a break and play one song by the next artist I'm going to talk about. The man's name is Will Marion Cook. Here's a track that he wrote as performed by Ethel Waters. The track is entitled "I'm Coming, Virginia."
Traffic to Dixie, hold it right at the line. Don't want nothing betwixt me and that old home of mine. I'm so homesick and lonely, every hour seems a day. But there is one and one only understands when I say, I'm coming, Virginia, I'm coming to stay.
Now you're listening to Ethel Waters singing a composition entitled I'm Coming, Virginia, which was a song that was eventually covered by such jazz luminaries as Bix Beiderbecke, Benny Goodman, Stephan Grappelli, maybe hundreds of other people. It's a song that was written by a man named Will Marion Cook, as I had mentioned, who was born in Washington, D.C. on January 27th, 1869. I'm mentioning the date because I want you to keep this in terms
the timeline,
right. He studied. Now, what makes him interesting and what unites him to the story that we've told so far is that, remember I had mentioned about Dvorak coming to America and having a big influence on helping African-Americans develop their talent, one of the first people to see that Africans actually had their African-Americans
and presented
and allowed it to be published. Well, Cook studied for a brief time with Dvorak at the National Conservatory of Music and eventually got up enough courage and confidence in his own music to go ahead and try to become a serious writer. His first attempt at theater, however, was a series of skits entitled Clorindy or The Origin of the Cakewalk. Now, if you remember, also we discussed
yes,
the cakewalk a little bit.
Cakewalk.
The thing is, what he had to do to perform in this theatrical composition is he resorted to all of the coon song style repartee that was part of the time, part and parcel. It was the only way that he would have ever been considered in the first place. So his family heard what he was doing, and this is a guy who had studied seriously. He had even gone to Europe and studied in Europe, and his mother had a heart attack when she heard what he had written. The family was absolutely appalled to see that a serious musician like Will Cook reducing himself to such bluntly commercial, which is to say racist, music. Anyway, he continued along the path that he saw fit. He brings his show to New York, and nobody would give him the time of day. He couldn't get the thing performed. However, what was happening is, around this time in the middle of summer, the theaters were too hot. There was no theater in New York in the summer. There was no air conditioning. So they would kind of just shut the theaters down. Then somebody had the bright idea, let's put the show up on the roof. Well, Will Cook told his crew, the people who were performing and singing his songs, that he had a chance to audition, even though he was totally making it up. Nobody was interested, but he shows up on a Monday anyway, and he says, I'm here to audition. And he was about to get kicked out of the theater when the conductor who was there said, give him a chance. Well, things went well. He actually got the chance to perform, and they liked it enough to say,
put you on the roof.
We're going to do this. You're going to perform on the roof. Finally, what ended up happening is Clorindy, or The Origin of the Cakewalk, finally opened on July 5th. Middle of summer, 1898, there was a cast of 26 African-Americans in the show. The operetta, which type of the style that he went for, was a mixture of comedy, songs, and dances, including the cakewalk. And this is amazing. Listen to this sentence. In some of the numbers, the performers actually sang and danced simultaneously. The first time this had ever been done on the stage. What he had essentially done here was he had formalized minstrelsy. He had taken this traveling, rough type of style and he made it a formal thing into a show on Broadway.
And there wasn't any lip syncing at this time in history.
One of the songs from the show, right, not at all. One of the songs from the show was called Who Dat Say Chicken in Dis Crowd? And it drew 10 encores. Of the evening, Cook himself said...
Stunning.
Negro, right? Isn't that amazing? Cook himself said, Negroes at last were on Broadway and there to stay. We were artists and we were going a long way. Well, either way, however you look at it, that might not have been true because eventually what happened was the show was successful in the short term, but racism prevailed and eventually the idea of African Americans on Broadway was viewed as a novelty. So people stopped attending. But either way, you could obviously still see that Cook was the first competent composer to take what was then known as ragtime and work it out in a musicianly way. Now, let's see. Just to continue to go on. At the turn of the century, Cook was composing his own other popular songs, and he was also the composer-in-chief and musical director for Williams and Walker's Broadway shows. Now, if you're Burt Williams, is Burt Williams, the first black man to perform and dignify the whole blackface minstrel thing outside of Broadway. Unfortunately, the Broadway audiences considered the Negro shows to be of novelty, as I said, and their popularity ceased around 1910. However, I would like to play one more track written by Will Marion Cook, this time as performed by UB Blake. Here is When the Pale Moon Shines. There's a short little piece as performed by UB Blake, written by Will Marion Cook, called When the Pale Moon Shines. Now, I'm playing that because I wanted to introduce Blake into the story, because Blake was also an important part of this transition here. He was born in Baltimore, Maryland in 1883. He was playing the organ by 6 years old, and he got his first job playing in a brothel at 15. He made his professional stage debut in a Pennsylvania medicine show at the age of 18. Now, in 1905, he moved to New York City, where he met Will Marion Cook. Will Marion Cook said that he was a very moody, weird guy, Marion Cook. He alienated a lot of people with his temper. But he befriended Blake, and he agreed to help Blake get his music published. So they went to a white publisher named Kurt Schindler. They brought the songs that Blake had written to this publisher. And so he starts, the publisher's sitting there, and he's starting to score the song to see to publish it. And he starts asking questions about modulation, and Cook went nuts. Cook started blowing up at this guy and says, "What right have you to question my protege? How long have you been a Negro?" To which Schindler said, "I'm only asking a question." He goes, "Well, you've no right to ask it." Now, before they knew it, Schindler was insulted by their attitudes, and he kicked them out the door. Blake's career, UB Blake's career, ended up getting set back by almost 10 years
from that experience.
By Cook's, temperament. However, the song that they brought in to get published, originally called Sounds of Africa, was eventually changed. The name eventually became the Charleston Rag, and here is UB Blake explaining his own song and then playing it.
I wrote this, ladies and gentlemen, in 1899. See, I composed it. I always say I wrote it. I could not write music then. I didn't start to write music until I was 15 years old. And I'll play the Charleston Rag. Now, the bass you hear, these people call it boogie. We called it the walking bass. See? Now, I'll play the Charleston Rag. Thank you.
All right, well, as Blake plays the Charleston Rag in the background, I'll continue his story. Having more or less failed with his chance to get published right away in New York City, he went back home to Baltimore, where he played in local establishments, and he actually was starting to meet up with people there, like Willie the Lion Smith and James P. Johnson. Those are both very famous piano players who would both soon travel to New York City themselves, set themselves up in Harlem, and become quite famous as ragtime and stride piano players in New York City. Blake would eventually meet another man named Noble Sissel, and together they became songwriting partners around 1915. As members of Joe Porter's Serenaders. They presented their first song that they had written together called It's All Your Fault to Sophie Tucker, and she, who was very known for promoting black songwriters. She was one of the earlier female singers who sang popular music. Mm-hmm. Tucker liked the song so much that she had arrangements made and used it in her act the night after she heard it.
Wow.
They started making their first money from that publication. Now, in 16, Sissel, Blake's partner, was invited to work for James Reese Europe in his Clef Club. Now we'll get to that in 1 minute. And within 3 or 4 months, he was leading his own group within that organization. The summer of that year, Blake rejoined him, and now they were both working with James Reese Europe. Now, who is James Reese Europe? Well, he was born in Alabama in 1881. At 22, he moved to New York and began playing piano in a cabaret. Around 1905, he was unknowingly influencing a songwriter by the name of George Gershwin, who at the time was only 7 years old, and he was sitting outside of a Harlem club listening to him play inside and decided he wanted to become a songwriter.
Wow.
Now, in 07, Europe was the musical director for Burt Williams, again, the black musician who would wear blackface in minstrel music but brought it dignity. In 1910, he founded one of the most unusual African-American organizations of the time. It was called the Clef Club, which was unique in that it was a part fraternal organization and part union. The building it purchased on West 52nd Street served as a club and an office for the buildings, for the bookings. The job of the Clef Club was to be sure that black musicians got paid fair and square. Mm-hmm. Instead of letting them being hired as waiters and then being asked to sing, they were going to be paid as musicians. That was going to do away with some of the nonsense that was going on money-wise. Now, Europe was the Clef Club's first elected president, as well as the conductor of its symphony orchestra. They eventually appeared at Carnegie Hall for the first time on May 2nd, 1912, and they were so well-received that they returned in 1913 and 1914. One American writer said that the popular music first invaded the concert auditorium when Europe played Carnegie Hall. The Carnegie Hall concerts gave the Clef Club Orchestra greater respectability among white society, too, and as a result, they were eventually engaged to play at many of the most elite functions, both in New York and even in London and Paris. At this time, also, remember that in New York City, whether you may or may not know it, before the turn of the century, or right around the turn of the century, ballroom dancing was the rage. And the most famous of all the ballroom dancers was a couple known as Vernon and Irene Castle. When the Castles met Europe at a private society party where his orchestra was playing, they eventually decided to make him their band leader. Now, Europe is now providing them with material. And one day he was at the piano playing a slow drag version of W.C. Handy's Memphis Blues. They heard it, loved it, and then he said, if you love it, why don't you write a dance for it? So he was what that ultimately means is that he became instrumental in the premiere and success of their most famous dance. They wrote this dance. They called it the Foxtrot.
Oh, wow.
And it was based on this arrangement eventually that James Reese Europe did of W.C. Handy's song, The Memphis Blues. Here it is. Thank you. All right, now we've got to continue with James Rees Europe's story. There's a lot to cover here because we didn't even get to the meat of what he's about. At the start of World War I, Europe enlisted as a private in the army. And after passing the officer's exam, he was asked by his commander to form a military band to become part of his combat unit, knowing his musical talent.
Mm-hmm.
Europe thought it was a great idea, but he said he could never convince New York City musicians to leave highly paid jobs to go to war. But he eventually did exactly that, even traveling all the way to Puerto Rico to recruit reed players for the band. When the unit arrived in France on New Year's Day 1918, it was the first African-American combat unit to set foot on French soil. Europe's band entertained troops and citizens in every city and visited and was received with great enthusiasm. Noble Sissel, the partner of UB Blake, said at the time that the jazz germ hit France in the person of James Rees Europe, and it spread everywhere they went. Throughout the war, Europe continued to write songs, composing the words to one particular song known as On Patrol in No Man's Land while hospitalized after surviving a gas attack. I have actually a copy of that song. Let's play a version of James Rees Europe with, let's see, the full name of his orchestra at this point is Lieutenant Jim Europe's 369th Infantry Band.
Boys, now take it slow. Are you ready? Eddie, a very good Eddie. Over the top, let's go. Quiet, quiet, else you start a riot. Keep your proper distance, follow along. Cover, mother, and when you see me hover, obey my orders and you won't go wrong. There's a minute buffer coming, look out. Hear that roar, there's one more. Stand fast, for there's a very light. Don't gasp for to find you all right. Don't start the bombing with those hand grenades. There's a machine gun, the holy spade. Alert, gas, put on your mask. Adjust it correctly and hurry up fast. Drop, there's a rocket for the fight barrage. Down, hug the ground, push your hand, don't stand. Creep and crawl, follow me, that's all. What do you hear? Nothing near.
By the way, I'd just like to remind you, you're listening to How Music Changed, part of American Hit Radio here on WHPC 90.3 FM. You can catch our shows on the internet if you want to catch this in full, or if you missed a part, if you want to catch any of our older shows, they're all available at AmericanHitNetwork.com or AmericanHitRadio.com. Catch up on all the history that we're trying to bring you up on. This is our fifth show in this series, of which is eventually going to be a full 250.
You probably want to play it again because it's hard to capture everything all at one go.
To bring all of this together. I even want to listen to them again. Well, let's continue with our story on James Rees Europe now. Now, at this time, at the time that he's recording these songs, Europe's group performed in a series of concerts with some of the greatest marching bands in France, Britain, and Italy. The thing is, they liked what they were hearing so much that they came up to Europe and they asked, for his music. Said, "We'd like to do some of the songs that you're doing. Could we borrow it?" So Europe said, "Sure." He handed over his music and let the bands try it. They did it, and it didn't sound at all like what Europe was doing. So they ask him why. They bring Europe over, and he listens to him, and he says, "Well, you're not playing it with the jazz styles." They didn't know what he was talking about. They eventually asked to examine the instruments.
And they were not any different?
They believed the instruments were doctored. No, these guys were just playing with this Americanized feeling that Europe was bringing to it, the syncopated stuff from ragtime and everything else that was an offshoot of jazz. Now, his band returned triumphantly to New York, parade and everything, on February 12, 1919, toward the end of the war, and soon began a tour of American cities. The final concert of his tour was at Mechanics Hall in Boston on May 9th, 1919. That evening, one of his percussion twins, as he called them, Herbert Wright, became angered at Europe because of the way he was directing him too strictly, and he attacked him with a knife during intermission.
Oh, that's not right.
As Noble Sissel, his partner, recalled, Jim wrestled Herbert to the ground. I shook Herbert, and he seemed like a crazed child, trembling with excitement. Although Jim Rees Europe's wound seemed superficial, they couldn't stop the bleeding, so he was rushed to a hospital. He turned to Sissel and he said, "Don't forget to have the band at State House at 9 in the morning. When I get out of the hospital, I'll have my wound dressed, and I'll have everything together for you to carry on, and I'll see you there." As it turns out, Europe's jugular vein had been severed, and the next day the papers carried the headlines, "Jazz King is dead." So, That ends one story rather abruptly and incredibly sadly. Meanwhile, Sissel's partner, UB Blake, later said of Europe, "He was our benefactor and inspiration. Even more, he was the Martin Luther King of music." Well, despite his many accomplishments, he never fulfilled his greatest ambition, which was to restore the Negro to the Broadway stage. It would remain for his students, Noble Sissel and UB Blake, to do exactly that. After Europe's death, Sissel and Blake got back together again, and they were encouraged by Europe's manager and the backers of the band to enter the white vaudeville circuit. There were very few black performers who were doing that, other than, of course, Burt Williams, who we mentioned a few times today, and never more than one on the same venue. But patterned after their Clef Club presentations, they did perform, but they refused to wear blackface, and they played only with a piano on stage. That was their only prop. Eventually, they put together a song, a show. The show is entitled Shuffle Along, and it opened in New York on May 23rd, 1921, fulfilling Reese Europe's ambitions to do exactly that. The show is a huge hit entitled Shuffle Along. Some songs you might still know to this day. Here's one of them, as performed by Alice Faye and Louisiana native Louis Prima, entitled I'm Just Wild About Harry.
I'm in love, so in love. Who is the guy, you're crazy about? Oh, who'd like to know, you'd like to know? Well, hear me shouting. I'm just wild about Harry, and Harry's wild about me. The heavenly blisses of his kisses fill me with ecstasy.
Just to clarify, I wanted to be sure that you understood that it wasn't Sissel or Blake who had anything to do with Europe's death. It was one of his percussionists named Herbert Blake.
Okay.
Now, Shuffle Along, this show that spawned this song, was one of them anyway, was the first all-black musical to become a box office hit, and it started a resurgence of African-American shows. Now, meanwhile, Will Marion Cook, do you remember him? That's the guy we started this whole thing with.
Okay.
He started to lead a band called the Southern Syncopators, also known as the New York Syncopated Orchestra, and they started to tour Europe and gave a command performance before England's George V. It was during this tour that Sidney Bechet discovered the soprano sax and began to develop his own technique on that instrument, which would expand his own jazz greatness. Now, that's my New York side of the story. Now we're going to bring it back to New Orleans. I had to tell that because I wanted to let you see that this was developing elsewhere as well. Meanwhile, though, in New Orleans, as I had mentioned, all these different styles were coming together.
So these are things that are happening simultaneously.
More or less simultaneously. The brew that we were talking about earlier in New Orleans began to combine with early rural blues music, which is also a freeform style, very much like jazz and yet also highly structured. It was really nothing more than a secularization of black church music. If you think about black church music, it's hymns arranged in a call and response chant, mm-hmm. like the way a preacher would say something and you'd respond to that. If you think about blues, when you would also repeat the same line twice, very similar roots. It's got the same thing going on. Like secular music, black church music featured pianos, tambourines, cornets, and a lot of expressive bent note singing, something that nobody else was doing, but this was happening in the black church. What's the difference between that and the blues? Well, the difference is that preachers would sing rhythmically during their sermons about God as opposed to singing about their problems. As Sidney Bechet had said, this is his quote, "It's like one was saying, oh God, let me be, and the other was saying, oh mister, let me go." Or the other way, oh God, let me go, instead of oh mister, let me be. Here actually is one preacher from New Orleans. His name is Reverend Isaiah Shelton. I want to give you an idea of what we're talking about. Here is Reverend Isaiah Shelton and part of a sermon of his entitled The Liar.
Just let me tell you what a liar will do. He's always coming with something new. Steal your heart with false pretense to make it out like a real bosom friend. And when he finds out you believe what he says, then that whole lie you're going to have his way. Bring you news from women and men. Make you fall out with dairy friend. And when a liar takes a notion to send them through where you lay around the neighborhood, get them news and nearly every day where you look out or you will see that liar coming to your house, or he will tell you such a lie, he'll surprise your mind.
So let's see what we've got here now, is what we're listening to. We've got rhythms, we've got syncopation, we've got a guy singing bent notes. There's a call and response sort of a feel going on. Brass bands could play this music very easily, incorporating what was coming from the Civil War. There was free form expression with the own person's personality getting involved into the music. And it was all happening over a semi-arranged structured chord pattern. That's jazz. That's what jazz is. All of this began to come together in New Orleans, and it infiltrated every aspect of New Orleans society. For example, for our next track, I want to play this. This is actually Sam Morgan's jazz band performing a gospel number recorded pre-1926. Just to put it in perspective, this track is entitled Over in Glory Land. With all these styles coming together and it's coming out of the church and everything else, there was bound to be one personality that would rise to the forefront. And the jazz leader in New Orleans around the turn of the century was a cornetist by the name of Buddy Bolden. As marching bands began to rag on songs and they were giving individual players in the band the chance to be expressive, personality and flair mattered when ragging. And Buddy Bolden was one of the biggest personalities of all. What he did that was unique was he brought his ragging style of brass band playing into the dance hall bands and started using it with elements of the blues and the call and response of the gospel church. That is what essentially made Bolden so phenomenal, by bringing it all together. Waltzes, polkas, rags, spirituals, blues, all of this blended together in the music of Buddy Bolden. He'd play clean shows for people until midnight. Then he'd play a song to have everybody go home. Then he'd play another song to bring everybody back in, and he'd play slow blues till 3:30 in the morning. Problem was, Bolden drank excessively, and he was extremely suspicious, even paranoid, and he refused to be recorded, which you could say he refused, but by the same token, around 1907, virtually nobody was being recorded anyway. But his illness eventually caused problems. He eventually attacked his mother with a pitcher. Because he was really going nuts. He thought his mother was poisoning him, and so he attacked her, and he just became totally unpredictable. By 1907, he was placed in the Louisiana State Insane Asylum. He was in the...
That's never good.
29 years old at the time, where he would stay until his death.
Ouch.
So that was the first chance to record early jazz that didn't happen. The second king of cornet out of New Orleans was a man by the name of Freddie Keppard. Now, he was another New Orleans cornetist who was getting a lot of work, and even enough to become an inspiration to a little boy by the name of Louis Armstrong, who would hear him when he was marching down the streets. He led a band in New Orleans called the Olympia Band. Mm-hmm. Keppard eventually toured the United States, bringing this strange new sound, this crazy blend of music that was coming out of New Orleans wherever he went. Traditional musicians, which is to say white musicians, and conservative ears hated it. But it was different enough to attract attention. Keppard eventually went on tour with the band that he called the Original Creole Orchestra, and they would tour with minstrel shows, the vaudeville circuit, the whole nine yards, and they did what the times demanded of them. They put cork on their faces to play in blackface, they would tell jokes, they would dress like common laborers, appealing to the crowd, and by acting out the whole coon song mentality. But they would play New Orleans jazz, and the white population slowly began to get it. But still, all in all, jazz music was still basically unknown outside of New Orleans. It wasn't until 1917 that things began to change. Yet another cornet player around this time in New Orleans, who was part of the early New Orleans music scene, but didn't get discovered until much later, was a player named Bunk Johnson. He was the lead cornet player in the Eagle Band, which provided inspiration also for Louis Armstrong and Sidney Bechet. Johnson would become well known later on as part of the jazz revival scene of the 1940s. So although he was there, they didn't record him either. Yet another guy who missed his chance. Well, now, no early recordings of jazz exist before 1917, which is why I'm spending so much time talking on this show and so little time playing music. The recordings didn't exist yet. There's a lot of reasons, though. First of all, A, logistics. The means to record a field recording, which is to say go somewhere and record what was happening there, didn't exist yet. Just wasn't there. Number two, the music was still considered novelty music. It wasn't popular enough to make the big city folk go down to New Orleans to want to record it. Since it wasn't formally written down, it wasn't even taken seriously anyway. And finally, racism. Quite simply, whites simply did not acknowledge yet that African Americans could create something new and artistic. Now, in 1915, though, Freddie Keppard was on tour in New York City when someone from the Victor Talking Machine Company offered to record his band. This is the same label at the time, by the way, that was selling huge amounts of records by Enrico Caruso, if you can recall. Keppard said no. Turned him down. Not interested. What a drag. They did record Freddie Keppard a little bit later, so if you want to hear what early jazz sounds like from the horn of Freddie Keppard, here's a track by Freddie entitled Stockyard Struts. That's a recording of Freddie Keppard made a little bit later than the time period that we're discussing. I think there's only two known recordings of him in the world by Freddie Keppard, if you can imagine.
Wow.
But he's an example of like of the very, very early New Orleans sound, and he would be considered the second king, cornet king of New Orleans. Meanwhile, though, as you would expect, as this starts to develop, of course, whites begin to have their, although you can look at this two ways.
They get it, and then
they start to get it, they start wanting to imitate it, but by the same token, it's only fair to say that in New Orleans, it was a big pool of a lot of different styles, the Creoles, the Blacks, the Whites, the Italians, the Irish, so they were all sort of developing it at the same time, to be fair. The problem was that the white musicians didn't really want to share. For example, there was a New Orleans musician named Papa Jack Lane. He was a contemporary of Buddy Bolden, the first king of New Orleans cornet. He ran a marching band in New Orleans, and he had to compete on all fronts with people like Buddy Bolden. So naturally, his styles paralleled those of the Black bands and the Creole bands. The thing is, he claimed to have innovated the style all by himself, personally.
Wink.
And he gave African Americans no credit at all. Lane is another one of those musicians who never recorded, so we don't know what he sounded like either. But certain players who passed through his Reliance Marching Band, that was the name of his organization, eventually formed a band of their own. And that band would eventually be called the Original Dixieland Jazz Band. Now, I've got to read something here because the jazz band eventually found their way north from New Orleans. The members of the band got the money to head up to Chicago for a gig. And here's an example of something that had happened down there. I think this is quite funny to relate. In April of 1916, their band was booked into a cheap cabaret called the New Schiller Cafe on 31st Street in Chicago, which was fortunate enough to be visited one Saturday night by some 60 determined women from the Anti-Saloon League, intent on exposing the evils of alcohol. With them came a reporter from the Chicago Herald. That story appeared the next day under the headline, 60 Women Rip Mask Off of Vice, which turned out to be a publicist's dream for the band. Here's the article as it was published. A line of taxicabs radiated from the Schiller to the east, west, north, and south. Tell me if any of this would make you want to not go.
Right.
In front of the doors, a crowd of people fought for admission. A perspiring doorman held them back. "Can't come in," he shouted. "We're crowded to capacity." Once inside, it was impossible for anyone to be heard. The shriek of women's drunken laughter rivaled the blatant scream of the imported New Orleans jazz band, which never seemed to stop playing. Men and women sat, arms about each other, singing, shouting, making the night hideous, while their unfortunate brethren and sisters fought in vain to join them. Well, that article made everybody wonder who this band was. Quite frankly, it did absolutely the exact opposite of what they thought. They figured that the Original Dixieland Jazz Band would have egg on their faces. They did the exact opposite. They just started to make these guys famous. Here's a track by the Original Dixieland Jazz Band entitled Back Home Again in Indiana. We'll talk about this track in a second because it's a pretty interesting story. But Nick LaRocca, who was an Italian in New Orleans, is the cornetist in this band. Now, Italians were probably just about as looked down upon as the African Americans were at various times throughout history, especially in New Orleans. There was all sorts of, like, there were mafia connections, allegedly, and they were killing, one of the chief of police was killed. So the Italians were a tough crowd, and LaRocca was, maybe for that reason, also felt a strong resentment toward the blacks or the African-Americans in New Orleans or the Creoles. And he went through Papa Jack Lane's band, who claimed to invent jazz anyway. So he said that it was that his boss got him started. And now it's Nick LaRocca who is claiming to have invented jazz. Now, that's a bit ludicrous, but again, the fact of the matter is that his band was the very first to record. This track that you're hearing, Indiana, in the background, is the very first jazz recording of an authentic New Orleans jazz band. They were also the first band to become famous outside of New Orleans. That story that we just told while they were playing in Chicago, mm-hmm. This is an amazing story. Al Jolson heard them and decided to hire them and arrange for them to be playing in New York City. Mm-hmm. So they come to the Paradise Ballroom, which was at the time located on Columbus Circle in Manhattan, just at the southwest corner of Central Park. And there the Original Dixieland Jazz Band opened on January 17th, 1917. At first, that first night, there was nothing but confusion and resistance from the dancers. They had no idea what to do with this. They're used to ballroom dancing. What do they do to this type of music? Eventually, though, resistance began to turn into pandemonium. People were going crazy. You could probably say that that night in 1917 was the absolute real true birth of the jazz age. This is when New Orleans music burst out of the city and is now being totally welcomed and people going nuts in New York City. Within a week, Columbia Records offered to record the band. The result was this track that we're hearing in the background, Indiana. However, after the track was recorded, Columbia executives were horrified by the din of this recording. They thought that it was noisy, they thought the band sounded out of tune, they didn't know how to play, so they shelved the recording. They refused to release it. Al Jolson went nuts. He was so angry that he took the test pressing from Columbia, and he was friends at the time with the Russian Grand Duke, who was the nephew of the Tsar in Russia. He brought the record with him, and he played it for the Grand Duke. The Grand Duke happened to love jazz. The Grand Duke also happened to hate Rasputin. Now, if you remember, at the time, Rasputin was the guy who was having all sorts of influence on the Tsar and his family. Turns out that this record, the Grand Duke calls up Rasputin and says, "I've got this great jazz record. You want to hear it? Why don't you come over and I'll play it for you?" It was the original Dixieland jazz band. Rasputin says, "Awesome, I'll be right there." That was when Rasputin was killed.
Wow.
He was coming over to hear a recording of the original Dixieland jazz band, and he was poisoned, beaten, set on fire. And I mean, they did so many things to Rasputin that it took him like 4 days to die, but they eventually killed him, and that was just because he wanted to hear the original Dixieland jazz band.
Died for jazz.
Anyway, later on, about within less than a month, Victor decided to pick up on the opportunity that Columbia blew. Columbia never released the record. Well, Victor then came to the band and they made them the same offer. The result was the actual first released jazz record of all time. This is the song that you could say kicked off the jazz age. Some people say it's artistically debatable. Some consider it barnyard slapstick imitation of real jazz. But it was a smash hit. Here's Livery Stable Blues by the original Dixieland Jazz Band.
Thank you.
There's the song that made all the difference. Now, to quote Louis Armstrong, these are his words. "Most of my records," he recalled decades later, "were by the original Dixieland jazz band, Larry Shields and his bunch. They were the first to record the music that I played. I had Caruso records too, Henry Burr, they were all my favorites. Then there was the Irish tenor, McCormick, had him too, beautiful phrasing. But it was the original Dixieland jazz band that was playing the music that Louis Armstrong knew he was going to be making famous soon. Eventually, the ODJB would be totally overwhelmed by the real bands that stayed in New Orleans. Folks like Kid Ory, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, of course, would all begin to take jazz to total new heights, while the original Dixieland jazz band would start to diminish in their relevance. However, they did have a huge influence on things like trad jazz and Dixieland.
Yes.
The huge revival would eventually owe a huge debt to the original Dixieland jazz band. But jazz was going to grow, and it was not going to be following them. It was going to be following the fourth great king of New Orleans, trumpet playing, who is playing in the background right now. We'll be getting to him in a future show, Mr. Louis Armstrong. I want to thank everybody once again for tuning in. This was a really, listening to my words, I hope you were able to follow everything. We'll be back next Friday with another edition of How Music Changed. If you're interested in hearing the show on the internet in its entirety, you can find it on AmericanHitRadio.com or AmericanHitNetwork.com. Again, thank you so much for listening. Heidi, thank you for your help and input.
Earl,
thanks for a great job engineering. See you both on Friday.
And you are in my arms, baby. The nightingale tells its fairy tale of paradise, where roses bloom, though I dream in vain. Oh, in my heart.